a huge domed monolith of rust-red rock pushed up from a desert floor, its deeply fissured bulk washed by streaks of color. The terrain around it resembled a rad-scoured hell zone, with nothing to see but drifting plains of reddish sand, broken by a few tangled thickets. The rock rose sheer from the surrounding sands, a gigantic structure of stone with rounded sides that appeared to be unscalable. Eons of erosion had cut deep grooves and furrows across its base. Bridget was irresistibly reminded of the skull of an insensible giant, with the rest of its fossilized remains buried deep underground. There was a brooding, somber magnificence to the gigantic monolith.
A rock, so?
Not just a rock. It is Ayers Rock, also known as Mount Uluru, the world's largest monolith and an aboriginal sacred site. In pre-dark days, it was Australia's most famous natural landmark.
Why would Quavel be there?
I have no idea as to the why, but as to the how...
Let me guess. I bet it has something to do with these vortex nodes of yours.
Not my vortices. The planets. And yes, Ayers Rock is a focal point for electromagnetic Earth energies. Otherwise, the aboriginal peoples would not have considered it a holy spot since time immemorial.
A column of statistics appeared on the right-hand side of the screen, and Bridget read the specifics.
Ayers Rock is 350 meters high and 9 kilometers in diameter. It's all that remains of a 300-million-year-old sandstone range, which extends underground some 3 kilometers. It literally is the biggest rock in the world.
Bry stared at the image on the screen.
Why is it so red?
It is the Arcos, a coarse-grained sandstone rich in the mineral feldspar. The red color is caused by the chemical decay of minerals and simple oxidation.
Rust?
Rust. The fresh Arcos is a gray color. It actually changes color during the day, almost like a mineral chameleon. Before sunrise, it's gray against the gray sky. At sunset, the rock can change in color from deep red to bright orange to light purple in minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Wizard.
Just because Kane is laid up, we don't need you to take his place as Lakesh's resident gadfly.
She turned toward Lakesh.
You seem to know a lot about it. Have you been there?
Lakesh straightened, shaking his head.
No. A couple of years back, when I was doing the initial research on naturally occurring quantum interface points, I suspected that the Uluru, as the Aborigines call it, might be a node. I did a little reading on it.
Shizuka stepped closer to the computer station.
Why is it called Uluru?
Magnify the image, Mr. Bry.
Bry obligingly tapped the mouse, and the screen swelled with a closer view of the rock formation. Barely visible, etched across the surface, was a series of curving, twisting, intertwining lines. Lakesh pointed to them.
Those arcs are called Uluru by the Aborigines. They represent the manifestation of a single life force, how everything is related. Thus, they revere all life, the Uluru. According to Aboriginal legend, when the ancestral beings completed their work of creation, they decreed that things must remain unchanged for all time. This dreamtime decree is the cohesive force that has kept the Aborigines in harmony with the land. The concept of harmony is universal.
What is dreamtime, anyway? I've heard of it, of course, but I never found out what it meant exactly.
I doubt anyone but an Aborigine would know what it meant. The dreamtime is a difficult concept for our minds to grasp. It's both past and present, and past renewed or brought into the present. It's the essence of what might be called the Aboriginal religion. Dreamtime and dreaming are translations from the Aboriginal words, but have little to do with dreams as we know them. Dreamtime focuses on the beginnings of life and its continuation. It is perpetuated by rituals and by ceremonies in sacred sites.
Like Ayers Rock. Let's talk about the material world for a moment. Assuming Quavel was transported from here to there, where would she be in relation to it?
There are many caves in Ayers Rock. Water dripping through the sandstone formed a number of galleries and caverns.
Let's narrow it down, then. What's the largest cavern?
Mr. Bry, see if that information is available.
Bry tapped a couple of keys, and a window appeared on the screen. Framed within it was a view of the monolith's base and a dark triangular cleft bisecting it. The shape and symmetry lent it an unmistakable resemblance to the female organs of reproduction. The resemblance was so marked that Filboid self-consciously averted his gaze.
The largest cavern is known as the Woman's Cave. Aboriginal women went there to give birth. It's also where fertility rites were conducted.
Bridget narrowed her eyes for a moment, then nodded in comprehension.
Sam just provided us with a signpost.
It appears so, yes.
Bridget addressed Bry.
Can you print out a map of the Ayers Rock vicinity that will pinpoint the location of the Woman's Cave?
Bry nodded.
On it.
I would imagine that the coordinates we feed into the Interfacer's database will take you right into it.
I'd prefer to arrive on the outside. I don't want to phase right into Sam's arms.
Filboid stepped forward, eyes shining with anxiety.
Hold on a second. Are you talking about using that Interfacer machine to travel there and rescue Quavel?
Bridget smiled at him with wry amusement.
That's the general plan, yes. It's how I, Grant, and Kane arrived on the moon and met you, remember?
It still seems a little risky.
I'd say it's a lot risky, but they won't listen.
Lakesh smiled a little patronizingly.
Mr. Bry feels the Interfacer is an unreliable and cantankerous piece of machinery. He fears it could malfunction and leave our team stranded in the middle of the Gobi, or it could do to them what the first one did, trigger a spatial and temporal anomaly and boot them all on an unscheduled trip through time.
Philboyd's jaw dropped in astonishment.
What?
Bridget couldn't help but laugh. She didn't know if it was the almost comical expression of befuddlement on his face or the need to break the tension that had been building up in her.
Lakesh's prototype of the Interfacer didn't function according to its design, and Bry has never let him forget about it.
The latest version of the Interfacer is completely retooled from the prototype. And, as I have said before, the chances are very remote it will interface with the radiations of another homemade black hole.
Filboid looked steadily at Bridget.
I honestly don't know why you're so hell-bent on going after Quavel, but why don't you and I go? We'll take one of the tabs. You know I'm a good pilot.
Bridget hoped she didn't sound insulting.
Thanks for the offer, but an op like this will require a lot more than piloting skills. And as for the reasons we're going after Quavel...
First and foremost, she is a useful resource.
And me and Kane owe her our lives.
Filboid cast his eyes downward as if ashamed. Bridget understood his objections. It had only been a few weeks since he had come to terms with the fact he would not live and die on the moon, and he looked at Bridget as something of an anchor in his new life.
Don't worry. I'm an old hand at rescue missions.
DeFore's voice suddenly filtered over the intercom.
In case anybody is interested, Kane is conscious. Take your time about coming to see him. He sure as hell isn't going anywhere.
Bridget was a little surprised and disconcerted that Domi elected to go to the armory, while she and Shizuka left to check on Grant and Kane. But the Outland girl lived by her whims and impulses, and Bridget figured her fierce pride would not allow her to compete with Shizuka for Grant's attention. When the two women entered the infirmary, they learned from DeFore that Domi's absence made little difference to the man.
Grant's still unconscious. If he doesn't show signs of reviving the next couple of hours, I'll hook him up to the EEG and see what readings I get.
Bridget looked past DeFore to the beds upon which the two men lay. Grant's eyes were closed, but his chest rose and fell steadily. An IV bag hung upside down to the left of the bed, dripping slowly into a shunt on his arm. Diagnostic scanners hummed purposefully, monitoring his heartbeat and blood pressure. The overhead lights had been dimmed, but she could still see the ashen gray hue of his complexion. Kane occupied the far bed. He also had an IV drip, but he was awake, staring up at the ceiling. His eyes were bagged and underlined by dark rings. His complexion was sallow. He didn't move at all. Shizuka moved closer to DeFore.
What's wrong with him?
I'm afraid he's paralyzed, at least temporarily. Neurotrauma. I'm sure the same thing is affecting Grant.
You're sure it's temporary?
No, I'm not sure. I haven't told either one of them yet.
Shizuka nodded in acknowledgement of the medic's diagnosis and crossed the room to Grant's bedside. Bridget strode over to Kane. His shadow suit had been removed, and he was covered to his midsection by a sheet. Even in the dim light, she saw the crisscross pattern of old scars on his chest. His face was pale and drawn tight over the facial bones, his hair in disarray. He looked like hell warmed over and left to congeal, but she tried not to think about it. Kane's eyes flicked toward her.
Grant's still out.
I know.
What the hell happened? DeFore says Quavel is gone.
Yes.
In a clipped, brisk, unemotional monotone, Bridget told him what had transpired and who they suspected was the power behind it all. Kane squeezed his eyes shut.
Should have killed the little son of a bitch when I had the chance.
You didn't have the chance, Kane. None of us did.
He opened his eyes again.
You know where he took her?
We think so. An idea, at least. Australia.
Australia?
Bridget poured a cup of water from a carafe and placed a straw in Kane's mouth. He drank gratefully.
Where in Australia?
Bridget told him about Ayers Rock and watched as his face became hard and cold.
I'm going with you.
You're not going anywhere.
Watch me.
Kane strained to raise his head from the pillow, the tendons in his neck standing out in relief like ropes.
Baptiste, get these damn straps off me.
Bridget's eyes suddenly stung. Kane was a proud man, absurdly so sometimes. She gazed with increasing consternation at his struggle to rise, which showed none of the wolf-like grace she had always silently admired. Blinking back brimming tears, she put a hand on his forehead.
You're not in restraints, Kane. You're paralyzed. So is Grant, more than likely.
Kane gazed at her uncomprehendingly for a long, silent moment. His face twisted into an expression she had never seen before. Utter horror and a soul-freezing terror. His lips moved, and it took him two attempts before he was able to speak.
Paralyzed?
Reba is pretty sure it's a temporary condition due to trauma of the nervous system. There's no reason to believe you won't make a full recovery.
Kane's head dropped back onto the pillow, his face sheened with sweat.
What if it isn't?
Nobody has thought that far ahead. There's no reason to at this juncture.
Kane stared at her beseechingly.
Bridget.
She felt her heart give a painful jerk. She forced herself to meet his stare. Several times over the past couple of years, Bridget had faced, then turned away from, the possibility that her soul and Kane's had been intertwined for a very long time, reincarnated over and over, destined to always find each other. Neither one of them had cared to seriously entertain such a concept. They were not, and never had been, romantically involved. He had risked his life on a number of occasions for her, but only rarely had he ever addressed her by her first name. She knew that most of the time Kane shied away from scrutinizing his feelings for her, just as she did. They were as deep as they were complicated, and the unspoken bond between them was an issue neither one discussed. When she was with Kane, always her intellect and emotions rioted within her. She always feared to closely examine her feelings for him, frightened they were far too intense for her to deal with. Their relationship was guarded, sometimes tense. Bridget tried to convince herself it was due to the fact she took pride in cool, analytical thinking, while Kane exhibited emotionalism, relying on his instincts. But she knew there were far deeper factors at work as well. From the very first time she met him, she was affected by the energy the man radiated, a force intangible, yet one that triggered a melancholy longing in her soul. That strange, sad longing only deepened after a bout of jump sickness both of them suffered during a Matt Tran's jump to Russia. The main symptoms of jump sickness were vivid, frighteningly real hallucinations. Lakesh had postulated the so-called jump dreams might not be hallucinations at all, but inchoate glimpses into other lives and other realities triggered by the quantum channels opened by the gateway units. At the time, Bridget had refused to consider that possibility, but now she wasn't so certain. At any rate, she and Kane never spoke of their shared vision, although Bridget often wondered if that spiritual bond was the primary reason he had sacrificed everything he had attained as a magistrate to save her from execution in Cobaltville. She knew the possibility confused him, made him feel defensive and insecure. That insecurity was one reason he almost always addressed her as Baptiste, rarely by her first name, so as to maintain a certain formal distance between them. Inhaling a great, shuddery breath, Kane squeezed his eyes shut and compressed his lips. Bridget knew he was processing the information. His magistrate discipline took over now. The training that had taught him to view all situations as a matter of tactics and critical problems that could be solved by judicious strategy. Finally, he spoke.
Leave her.
Bridget cocked her head at him quizzically.
What? Leave who?
He opened his eyes, and she inwardly cringed from the cold, merciless gleam in them. She had seen that gleam many times before.
Quavel, don't risk yourself or Shizuka or Domi over her.
Don't you owe her your life?
I spared hers and Dulce. We're even. But we're not talking a matter of debt. Quavel is my problem. You can't sacrifice yourself or anyone else over someone that is my responsibility.
So, since Quavel is your responsibility, and you can't do anything about it in your present condition, she should be sacrificed, not us?
He nodded as best he could.
You said her abduction was bait for a trap. The most reasonable tactic when approaching a trap is not to spring it.
And what about Quavel and her baby?
Sam doesn't mean her harm. If he did, she would have never been allowed to escape Area 51, with or without help. In my estimation, she's been acting as a lure ever since she got here. Whether she knew it or not doesn't really matter.
Bridget pondered Kane's words for a thoughtful moment.
You've got a point. Sam wants Lakesh swung to his side, so he's probably counting on Lakesh coming for Quavel, like a prisoner exchange.
Exactly. If Lakesh stays behind, and if he captures you three, he's got three more hostages to use against us.
And if nobody comes to rescue Quavel, he still has her, and her child. It's the classic win-win.
And he also knows the location of Cerberus, so he could stage an assault at any time. He has his own forces and those of the Barons who've allied with him.
I can always rely on you to pour cold water on any acts of idealism that I might entertain.
He forced a smile.
I've learned from the best.
His eyes suddenly flicked to the left, and Bridget looked up, following his gaze. Shizuka approached, her face locked in an impassive mask, but her dark eyes glittered.
Grandson has not roused. His spirit sleeps. I fear it will not awaken.
Kane's jaw muscles knotted.
He'll pull through. He's the toughest man in the world. Compared to him, I'm made of spun sugar.
Aye. But perhaps his spirit will awaken if we punish those who did this to him and to you.
Bridget nodded and gingerly flexed her fingers, wincing slightly at the pull of the liquid bandage on her hands. Other than that, her movements were unimpaired.
Let's get it done.
Kane raised his head, face registering equal measures of dismay and anger.
Get what done? I thought we agreed.
No, we didn't agree to anything. I listened to your input and gave it due consideration. But I'm not leaving Quavel in the hands of the Imperator, either as a hostage or as a willing co-conspirator.
Anger won out over apprehension on Kane's face.
She's my responsibility, Baptiste, not yours.
You can't make that decision only for yourself. That's what always infuriated you about Lakesh. Anything and everything that any one of us chooses to do affects the others. You know that.
Listen, Baptiste.
I'm not going to sacrifice Quavel because you're incapacitated. Nor will I allow Sam to terrorize us here without doing something to stop him. He may only be trying to prove to us that resistance against his authority is futile, but that doesn't mean we have to buy into it.
You have no idea of the kind of defenses he might have around that place.
We have no idea if he has any, either.
The risk is too great.
I think it's acceptable.
You can't do it.
It's not like you can stop me.
Bridget regretted the cruelty of her response, but she knew slapping him in the face with the cold reality of the situation was the only way to persuade him to stop badgering her. Over the past 2 years, Bridget had come to accept risk as part of her way of life, taking chances so that others might find the ground beneath their feet a little more secure. She didn't consider her attitude idealism, but simple pragmatism. If she had learned anything from her association with Kane, Grant, and Domi, it was to regard death as a part of the challenge of existence, a fact that every man and woman had to face eventually. She had vowed to accept it without humiliating herself if it came as the result of her efforts to remove the yokes of the baronies from the collective neck of humanity. She never spoke of it openly, certainly not to the cynical Kane, but she had privately vowed to make the future a better, cleaner place than either the past or the present. Kane started to speak again, then subsided, laying his head back down. For one long second, their eyes met. Kane didn't speak, but his eyes were saying things he had never spoken aloud. Bridget could only return his gaze, wondering again why they were so fearful of revealing their innermost selves to each other, especially now, when time and life were on the wing. Suddenly, Bridget bent over and kissed him with a fierce, passionate possessiveness. He uttered a murmur of surprise as her tongue touched his. Then, just as suddenly, she broke the kiss and wheeled away to Shizuka.
Let's go.
Domi tested the action of her Detonix Combat Master pistol. Since the stainless steel gun weighed only a pound and a half, it was perfectly suited for a girl of her petite build. When she had first selected it from the redoubt's armory nearly 2 years ago, Grant had expressed doubt she could handle the recoil. She had never experienced problems with it, except during the period when she was recovering from a bullet that shattered a bone in her right shoulder. Before coming into the armory to pick up her weapons, Domi had dressed in whipcord pants and hiking boots. The shirt sleeves of her khaki shirt were rolled up, and a long-billed cap was on her head. Ejecting the 7-round magazine from within the pistol's checkered walnut grip, she inspected the spring mechanism, then slid the clip back in place. She slid the handgun into the shoulder holster attached to the combat harness she wore over her shirt. Briefly, she inspected one of the tungsten carbide pellet guns the Moonbase refugees had brought. The pistol held the general configuration of a revolver, but instead of a cylinder, a small round ammo drum was fitted into the place where there was normally a trigger guard. There wasn't a trigger, just a curving switch inset into the grip. The barrel was unusually long, nearly 10 inches in length. The weapon was made of a lightweight alloy that resembled dulled chrome. A unit of energy inside the grip moved a piston that propelled the explosive projectile. She had yet to test fire one, so she put it back in the crate where she had found it. Reaching down, she made sure her knife, with its 9-inch wickedly serrated blade, was securely sheathed to her right calf. It was her only memento of the 6 months she'd spent as Guana Teague's sex slave in the Tartarus pits of Cobaltville. She'd sold herself into slavery in an effort to get a piece of the good life available to Vill dwellers. Since Vill society was strictly class and caste-based, the higher a citizen's standing, the higher he or she might live in one of the residential towers. At the bottom level of the Vills was the servant class, who lived in abject squalor in consciously designed ghettos known as the Tartarus pits, named after the abyss below hell where Zeus confined the Titans. They swarmed with a heterogeneous population of serfs, cheap labor, and slaves like her. She ended her term of slavery by cutting the monstrous Teague's throat with the blade, and saved Grant's life in the same impulsive act. Domi rarely dwelled on the past, but she often replayed how she had cut Guana's throat and how the blood had literally rivered from the deep slash in his triple chins. She always smiled in recollection of kicking his monstrous body as it twitched in post-mortem spasms, just as she smiled at the memory of Grant comforting her and thanking her for saving his life. Thinking about Grant caused her lips to twitch unconsciously in a half-frown, half-smile. Whenever she thought about the big man with his lion's growl of a voice, she felt a mingling of love, anger, and disappointment. She loved the man for his qualities of courage and compassion, but she experienced anger and disappointment that he never allowed that compassion to turn into passion, at least not toward her. Domi was too practical, too pragmatic to expend much energy on girlish daydreams that had already proved to be lost causes, particularly since entering into a relationship with Lakesh. A relationship, she reminded herself bleakly, that had yet to be revealed to Grant, despite his bringing his Japanese lover right into Cerberus. As angry as Shizuka's presence made her, Domi knew Grant had not done it to hurt her. He was not that petty. Grant presented a dour, closed, and private persona, rarely showing emotion. He was taciturn and slow to genuine anger, but when he was provoked, his destructive ruthlessness could be frightening. With him, slights were never forgotten, and she knew he still stung from the whip of angry words she had lashed at him months ago.
Big man, big chest, big shoulders, legs like trees. Guess they don't tell the story, huh?
Domi regretted speaking those words almost as soon as they left her lips, but she had never apologized. When Grant rejected her love again on that day, she swore it was for the last time. Then, a month or so later, when she came across Grant and Shizuka locked in a fierce embrace, she also swore she would never forgive him. Even so, she could not bear to see him lying injured and comatose in the infirmary. Shaking her head, Domi tried to drive the memories of that night from her mind. There were a lot of memories swimming around within the walls of her skull she would as soon have excised, and that brief glimpse of Grant showering the Japanese woman's face with passionate kisses topped the list. Another memory she wished could be removed from her brain was her 2 weeks in captivity within the vast subterranean installation of Area 51. Both she and Kane had been shown the end result of their war against the Barons, dying hybrid infants. Domi still didn't know why the sight of the dying hybrid babies horrified her so profoundly, filling her with guilt and remorse. After all, she had come to the Dreamland installation in the Nevada desert for the sole purpose of killing as many hybrids as she could. The very concept of the hybrids triggered a xenophobic madness in her, the overwhelming urge to kill them, as she had killed muty borer beetles that sometimes infested into the outland settlement in which she had been born. But upon visiting the nursery-turned-morgue, she felt only shame, as if the guilt of the entire human race were laid on her small shoulders. Kane seemed to understand her point of view. She hoped he did, but it didn't really matter. They hadn't spoken of what they had witnessed or what they went through during their captivity. Kane was reticent to talk about it, particularly to Bridget. Domi hadn't blamed him, and she had kept her own knowledge of his experiences to herself. At the sound of footsteps, she turned toward the door. Bridget and Shizuka swept into the armory, moving very purposefully.
"You're ready. Good."
Domi nodded, moving to a crate of grenades.
"Already told Feral to have a survival pack waiting for us in the ready room."
In her characteristic mannish stride, Bridget crossed the armory to a row of metal lockers arranged against the far wall. She opened one of the locker doors and removed a jet-black one-piece garment from a hook. Swiftly, she stripped down to her underwear and began pulling on the shadow suit, first opening a magnetic seal on its right side. The garment had no zippers or buttons, and she put it on in one continuous piece from the hard-soled boots to the gloves. The fabric molded itself to her body, adhering like another layer of epidermis. She smoothed out the wrinkles and folds by running her hands over arms and legs. At the same time, Shizuka shrugged out of her jacket and began donning the pieces of samurai armor over her kamishimo. She did so with the same smooth deftness as Kane and Grant had put on their magistrate exoskeletons. Shizuka removed the two swords from the case and slid the scabbards through the wide green sash knotted around her small waist. She crossed her arms over her torso, then slid both the katana and tanto from the scabbards with lightning speed. She spun them experimentally, the flat blades cutting bright wheels in the air over her head. Then she returned the two swords to the scabbards in the same blurred motions. Domi glanced over her shoulder at her. Shizuka met her eyes stolidly. If Domi had been capable of blushing, she would have flushed bright red from anger. She clamped her jaws shut on the obscenity that sprang to her tongue. Shizuka's brief performance was a none too subtle reminder of the night the two of them had dueled in the California desert. Shizuka had done more than defeat her. She had humiliated her in front of Grant. The memory of that night was still like a lit match applied to the most tender part of her ego. Bridget had paid no attention to either woman. She put on a combat harness, then removed a copperhead from a notched wooden rack within a gun case. From the rear of the case, Bridget took a black 6-inch-long cylinder and screwed it carefully into the blaster's bore. Bridget turned to Shizuka.
"Sorry, I don't have a helmet."
Shizuka shrugged as if the matter were of little importance.
"I know nothing about Australia or the Aborigines Lakesh spoke of. Do they still exist?"
"That's hard to say. They maintained a culture that thrived unchanged for about 50,000 years. So if they were half as resilient as America's own Aboriginal people, then my guess is yes, they still exist."
"Are they same as Sky Dog's tribe?"
"No. Pre-dark anthropologists usually classified the Australian Aborigine as a separate race, the Australoid, because they're so distinct from the Caucasoid, the Mongoloid, and Negroid groups. But the Australian policy toward them was much the same as it was toward the American Indian."
"Killing them off?"
Bridget nodded dolefully.
"I'm afraid so."
How do you know so much about them?
Brigid smiled wanly. She wasn't quite the ambulatory encyclopedia she appeared to be, since most of her seemingly limitless supply of knowledge was due to her eidetic memory, but her apparent familiarity with an astounding variety of topics never failed to impress and occasionally irritate Kane.
I don't. Not really. Not even anthropologists knew everything about them. The little I know is from skimming through the database from time to time, looking for clues to Archon influence on their culture.
Shizuka lifted an eyebrow.
Were there any? Not specifically. But I did find some interesting correlations with the Anunnaki.
Grab some grins!
Brigid wasn't offended. She joined Domi at the crates, picking and choosing from their lethal contents. Both of them took four grins apiece, an Alsatex flashbang, two Incens, and a Hi-X. They attached them to the combat harnesses and clipped three spare magazines for their guns to the harnesses as well. Domi patted her spare magazines.
Primed!
Brigid repressed a smile at the girl's use of the mag slang she had heard Grant and Kane employ on numerous occasions. The three women left the armory and strode down the main corridor to the command center. The lights were dimmed to simulate sunset. Bri and Nora were the only people in the complex. They stood in front of the medical monitor, speaking in whispers. They looked up, startled, when Domi, Shizuka, and Brigid entered. Bri nervously extended a tri-folded rectangle of paper to Brigid.
I've got your map, but...
Brigid took the map from his hand.
But what?
Nora answered the question.
We've lost Quivel's life signs.
Before Brigid could request a clarification, Lakesh spoke from the doorway of the ready room.
There could be many reasons why we're not receiving her transponder's telemetry. We know from past experience it doesn't necessarily mean she is dead. If we began the last rites every time the biolink signals were interrupted or blocked, we'd have sung funeral dirges for just about everybody in Cerberus.
Bri cast him an annoyed sideways glance.
I know that, but I thought they should know beforehand about the worst-case scenario.
Thanks, but I always take those kinds of scenarios into consideration before I do anything.
The latitudinal and longitudinal coordinates have already been programmed into the interfacer's destination buffer.
So you found a parallax point in the area?
Actually, we found about a dozen of them, some of them overlapping. It's a powerful vortex zone. We selected one that should bring you to within a couple of miles of Ayer's Rock.
Phil Boyd was in the ready room, leaning over the table. On it lay a square metal and leather case containing survival rations, such as concentrated foodstuffs and bottles of purified water. But he wasn't examining that. The man's attention was focused on a shape that resembled a very squat, broad-based pyramid made of smooth, gleaming alloy. It appeared to be only 1 foot in overall width, its height not exceeding 10 inches. From the base protruded a small power unit and a keypad. Brigid removed the power unit and pushed the keypad into a slot.
You've seen the interfacer before.
Yeah, but I never looked at it closely. It sure doesn't seem like it can do all the things you claim it can do. It looks like an incense burner from the 60s.
The pyramid shape is not arbitrary or aesthetic. Energy progresses by four different routes, rejoining in a single conclusionary point at the apex. The energy flows in a helix pattern, exactly opposite and of equal frequency. The intensity on each side of the vortex at any given point triggers a quantum induction shift by vibrational resonance.
Phil Boyd nodded gravely.
Oh, and I thought it would be complicated.
He caught Bridget's eye and winked conspiratorially. Lakesh frowned and tugged at his nose.
I'm wondering if this is such a good idea after all.
I don't recall anybody saying it was a good idea.
Brigid closed and latched the rations case. She handed it to Shizuka, who slung it over a shoulder by the strap.
The mission just seems impulsive. As Kane would say, half-assed. Jumping into dark territory without knowing the lay of the land.
Brigid regarded him grimly.
There's no way to know the lay of the land without making a phase transit, Lakesh. So we'll kill two scream wings with one stone. Rescue Quivel and learn about the Outback.
Besides, we didn't get dressed up for nothing.
Lakesh gave her a jittery, nervous smile. He had expected nothing else from Domi than the attitude that all life-risking escapades were grand, exhilarating larks. But Bridget's intense drive to undertake the mission disturbed him. He had always admired the way she could swiftly meld thesis and antithesis into a synthesis of diverse, sometimes contradictory concepts. Or at least, she had been capable of that until Kane's simplistic approach to life's vagaries infected her. Picking up the interphaser, Bridget carried it into the gateway unit. When making phase transits from the redoubt, they always used the Mattrans chamber because it could be hermetically sealed. She placed it on the floor and waited for her companions to join her. Shizuka hesitated only a fraction of a second before stepping into the chamber. Domi leaned forward and planted a quick kiss on Lakesh's cheek, then climbed up to the platform, pulling the brown-tinted armaglass door closed on its counterbalanced hinges. Bridget exchanged a long look with the two women.
Are we ready?
Do it.
Shizuka ducked her head.
Hi.
Bridget knelt and touched the interphaser's inset activation toggles. As she stood, a waxy, glowing funnel of light fanned up from the metal apex of the pyramid. It looked like a diffused veil of backlit fog with tiny shimmering stars dancing within it. Shizuka stared in wonder, and as she stared, the light expanded into a gushing borealis several feet wide, spreading out within the chamber. A thready pulse of vibration tickled their skin, and shadows crawled over the armaglass walls, moving in fitful jerks and leaps. A faint hint of a breeze brushed their faces and ruffled their hair.
One at a time. One at a time what?
Bridget gestured to the shimmering fan of light.
Walk into that, over the top of the interfacer.
Shizuka eyed it uncertainly.
That's all there is to it?
Domi smiled cruelly.
Sometimes.
She stepped toward the pyramid and over it. Then she fell headlong into infinity. Her consciousness was a confusion of speed and distortion, a plunging, spinning whirlpool that was all inside her head but seemed immense enough to encompass the entire galaxy-flecked universe. Around and around, faster, lurching, rolling, caught helplessly in a torrent of energy that somehow was not energy, of a raging flame that did not burn but chilled with a cold deeper than a gale whipping from the lifeless vacuum of space. Always before, Bridget had experienced the interphaser transition between vortex nodes as little more than an insistent tug, the sensation lasting such an infinitesimal tick of time it couldn't be measured. What little her conscious mind retained of the phasing process from one node to another was little more than a splintered fragment of a long-ago dream. Now she plunged like a handful of electric impulses flung out among the stars like grains of sand. All around her, suns burned with a pure, clean radiance. The clouds of nebulae glowed silver against the primal black. Constellations wheeled and glittered. She could feel the movement of the universe pulsing against her, hear the songs sung by the stars. Then she floated alone in a void. She groped for Shizuka and Domi and couldn't find them. Bridget couldn't even sense her companions. A crushing weight of loneliness pressed down on her. She felt cut off from everything she knew as reality. The limbo in which she swam was like being trapped in a purgatory between existence and non-existence. Somehow, she knew life and death were utterly meaningless concepts in the dream in which she was caught. Then she heard a low roar, a distant rumbling that came in gusts with whistling notes in between. She couldn't truly hear it, but sensed it as a pattern of energy in the invisible current sweeping her naked soul into a maelstrom where the past, the present, and the future all seemed intertwined in one vast tapestry she couldn't see, but could sense nevertheless. The roar swelled to a mourning, moaning wail, and then to piping, a shrieking, overlaid with deeper tones that were like a distant, deep, throbbing drumbeat against her mind. It rolled through her like breakers on a beach, in a steady, heavy rhythm, or the steady beat of the invisible wings of a giant bird. Shadow shapes flitted and swam before her, moving in jerks and whirls to the music. The shadows lengthened, shortened, and then became dark figures wearing only loincloths and feathered headbands. Their deep brown faces were decorated with swirls and strips of white clay. The figures weren't stable or stationary. They shifted, they changed, they became blendings of animal and human. Some sported fanged muzzles, others leathery bat wings. Colorful patterns and figures writhed, weaving into twisting geometric shapes. There were colors she had never before seen, let alone imagined. The beat of the music penetrated to the core of Bridget's soul, acting like a magnet to pull her into the dance. She passed from one dancer to another, and sometimes the hands reaching out for her were claw-tipped paws. A man leaped out of the shapes surrounding her, dancing and capering in a mad dervish whirl. Around his hips was a loincloth bearing a complex design of intertwining curves and arcs. For some reason, Bridget saw the designs clearly, far more clearly than anything else about the figure. The man's otherwise naked body was painted with alternating strips of bright yellow and red on his chest, midriff, and arms. In his right hand, he held what seemed to be a long piece of rawhide cord with a hollow, sharp-pointed bone attached to its end. The man danced with frenetic energy, whirling the bone over his head. It gave off a low, ominous hum. The hum deepened and slowly became a blend of whispers speaking to her, but all of the whispers held an indefinable note of sad serenity. Then they began to sing the Inma, the epic song cycle of beginnings. Slowly, Bridget understood that she was dreaming, but they were dreams someone else wanted her to dream.
Long, long ago, before the Chukorpa, the dream time, before time, the world was soft and wobbly and had no shape. Then at the beginning of dream time, Waramurungundi came out of the sea. She created the land, gave birth to the people, and gave them their language. Inga, the giant ancestral crocodile, who got the bumps on his back when he was blistered in a fire, made the rock country. Marahuti, the sea eagle, brought water lilies in his claws and planted them on the floodplain. When these beings finished their creations, they became part of the land, where they remain today. Waramurungundi is a white rock in the woodlands. Inga is a rock outcrop shaped like a crocodile's back. These places are our sacred sites that still have the power and energy of dream time.
Is that where I am? Am I in dream time?
Our most holy of sites is Uluru, the life energy in stone form. Long ago, the Kunia, the snake people, journeyed from the waterhole Paku Paku west of Uluru. These snake people were peaceful and non-poisonous. They came to a large flat sandhill in the center of which was a waterhole.
Bridget received a blurred impression of a lizard thing walking upright on slightly bowed, powerful legs. The tough, brownish hide had the suggestion of scaliness. The narrow, elongated skull held large, almond-shaped eyes, black vertical slits centered in the golden, opalescent irises. She had seen such a creature before.
They made their camp there, and for a time, life was very good. Each day, the Kunia women were able to find plenty of food, which they carried home to the camp in their curved wooden carrying dishes. They prepared their bread from seeds gathered from grasses on the plain and cooked it in the ashes of their fires. The Kunia men, after hunting kangaroos, emus, and wallabies, liked to lie resting at the edge of the sandhill as the sun set. While the Kunia people were staying at Mount Uluru, however, life did not remain peaceful. A party of venomous snake men, the Liru, were traveling around in the Pichanchachara country. The Liru camped at Kachachuta, and then decided to approach Mount Uluru to attack the Kunia. They were led by the great warrior Kulikujiri, and traveling in a large group, they crossed the sandhills and arrived at the camp of a powerful Kunia woman named Kulari. Kulari had separated herself from the rest of her people as she had just given birth to a child. Enraged by the attack and desperate to protect her child, she sprang at the Liru with her child in her arms, spitting out Arukwita, the essence of disease and death. Many of the Liru were killed, but they continued to attack. A young Kunia warrior challenged Kulikujiri to a fight to the death, and Kulikujiri, after an arduous battle, fatally wounded the Kunia man, who crawled away over the sandhill. Kunia Inkridi, the mother of the slain youth, then rose in a fury and struck Kulikujiri a great blow on the nose with her digging stick. He died in agony, his blood streaming over the surface of the land, leaving stains on the rock that remain today. Kunia Inkridi mourned for her lost son. She covered her body in red ochre and sang and wailed into the night. She also spit out Oroquita, and any man approaching that site today will be stricken. Meanwhile, a huge battle took place between the Liru and the Kunia at the waterhole on the top of the sandhill. The Liru speared a great many Kunia, and, victorious, left the area and went back to Katajuta. Kunia Incredi, the great mother snake, despaired. Hearing of the death of her people, she sang the Oroquita song to kill herself and the remaining Kunia.
Slowly, Brigid began to understand that the Anangu, the aboriginal peoples, believed the area around Mount Uluru was inhabited by their ancestral beings, whose activities were recorded at many separate sites. At each site, the events that took place were to be recounted to each generation. There was a physical feature of some form at each ancestral site that represented both the activities of the ancestral being at the time of its formation and the living presence of Chukurpa, the Dreamtime, within that physical feature. Whatever its form or appearance, animate or inanimate, it embodied the essence of the Chukurpa, locked forever within it.
At the close of the Chukurpa period, when the giant sandhill turned to stone, these epic events were enshrined in stone also. The route of the Liru men from Katajuta to Mount Uluru is marked by rows of desert oaks, which are the bodies of the invaders, while the tracks of the Liru men were turned into deep fissures on the southwestern face of the rock. The spears the Liru men threw made marks in the sand, which are the holes in the cliff face. A large split boulder was once the body of the Kunia woman Kulari, who gave birth at this place. Within the boulder is a small cave in which her child was born. The boulders in front of the cave were once Kulari and her child. Pregnant women come to this cave to give birth, believing that Kulari will give them an easy delivery. When the young, fatally wounded Kunia warrior crawled away, the track he left became a watercourse. He died at a place where today there are three waterholes, each of which contains the blood of the dying man transformed into water. The victor, the leader of the Liru, Kulikujiri, became the large square boulder, while his nose, which was cut off by Kunia Incredi, stands out as a huge slab that has split off the main rock. The bodies of Kunia Incredi and her husband remain today as large and small boulders and rocks. The fig trees that tenaciously grip the smooth rock surface and send roots burrowing into the crevices are their hair.
The song and the pageantry of imagery went on for a long time until visions, flashes of a more recent reality rather than ancient myth, began to emerge from the shadows and penetrate Brigid's mind. She saw from the oceans on the east and west, and from the great red rock of Mount Uluru, there stood not a single building or settlement of man. It had not always been so. There had been teeming cities on the vast continent, some of them even mentioned by names in the song. But now only their memories remained, underscored by a bitter, primal resentment. A long and vicious conflict between two starkly different ways of life dragged on for many, many years, and the memory of it, centuries later, still aroused strong emotions of hatred, sadness, and rage. Invaders came, the Piranipa, with white skin and rapacious appetites, who tramped toward a great monolith of red rock rising from the desert floor. She saw the council fires of the great Anangu clans, putting aside their differences, their tribal feuds, to unite for a common cause. She saw spears flying, rifles belching flame, dark natives and white invaders falling and dying. Brigid knew, with the limited natural resources of the arid lands, the Aborigines and the Piranipa could not live side by side in peace. The invaders fenced out the natives from their ancestral lands and tried to destroy first their way of life, then their spirits. By the time huge cities sprang up on the continent, the centuries-long genocidal warfare had reduced all but the Mutijulu people to less than memories. The images swam faster now, flashing for only a split second in Brigid's mind. The vast backdrop of the sky turned scarlet, seeming to swell and then ripping open as if it were rotten old cloth. A bloom of distant hellfire burst open, and a sheet of flame surged outward and upward. The waves of the sea divided, and the orange-yellow incandescent flare poured into Bridget and filled her to the backs of her eyeballs. A coruscating wall of fire scorched across the ocean, riding a booming shockwave, pushing the ocean ahead of it in an overlapping series of mile-high tsunamis. Bridget couldn't look away. A vast mushroom cloud towered from the horizon, shot through with arcing skeins of blinding, destructive energy. A wall of smoke swept over the land. In its wake, she saw ruined cities, overgrown with vegetation. Everywhere there was death. Bridget saw the whole world spread out below her like an endless mural of horror. She passed like a phantom wind over the gloomy wastes, gazing down on the legacy of the nuke cost. The images seemed to tumble over one another in their haste to enter and exit her mind. Everywhere there was death. Corpses and animated cadavers, with their flesh peeled and blistered, their internal organs hanging out, boiled and burst, their empty eye sockets weeping bloody tears. Where there had once been lush and fertile fields, the desert swept in, a sea of sand lapping at the spires of half-buried skyscrapers. Instead of cities and towns, only vast, ugly craters pockmarked the ground, seething with poison. Ungainly caricatures of human beings lurched across the wastelands, forlorn monstrosities birthed and molded by an outraged nature. Bridget tried to cringe, praying they wouldn't see her. She soared over toxic swamps, percolating with a foul and fetid soup, and watched people desperately trying to snatch the most meager of existences from their half-dead surroundings. She saw babies dragged cold and lifeless from rad-damaged wombs, and she wanted to weep, but phantoms couldn't shed tears. Flying up and arcing down again over bitter seas, she plunged through a maelstrom of buffeting memory, reliving in a heartbeat all of her own suffering at the hands and bestial imaginations of the depraved men who sought to rule the ravaged ruin of the world. Bridget understood it as the Aborigines did, the apocalypse that had swept the invaders from their land, from their sacred sites. The fences had fallen down, the men who stood guard over them had sickened and died. Over a period of many years, their beloved land healed itself, renewed itself. The process was long and painful, but the Mutijulu people could afford to be patient. They had waited hundreds of years for the invaders to lose their grip on their land, on their world. But a new group of Piranipa invaders had arrived, and they crawled and crept within the stony bosom of Mount Uluru, infesting it, infecting it, corrupting it. And if they corrupted the Uluru, they corrupted life itself. She was flung headlong on the swirling gales, the clean, fresh wind of hope filling her lungs with an intoxicating purity. She raced upward toward the sun, exulting in its life-giving radiance. A voice, a single one, not the mixture, spoke gruffly.
Make a choice. Dream and die, or awaken and fight.
The image of the sun faded, and Bridget was back in the void, a black so deep she knew she was at the far, far end of dreamtime. She also knew she had a choice of whether to awaken or continue to dream. Then she felt a throbbing pain, and a moment later she became aware of her body, and she knew she had decided to awaken. Or that's what she fervently hoped. When Erica Van Sloan finally woke up, moonlight peeped in through the polarized sheet of plastic covering the crack in the cavern ceiling. She sat up quickly, looking around the rock gallery converted to living quarters. She was quite alone. Not even Abbott and Costello, as she called her baronial guardsmen, were in attendance, and she wondered briefly if Baron Beausoleil had ordered them away. Sloan went to the bathroom and took a long, hot shower. When she was finished, she dried herself in front of the mirrored squares glued to the stone wall and inspected her body for any sign of changes, as she did at least twice a day, particularly since she had discovered the streak of gray in her hair. As far as she could determine, it had not widened or lengthened, which was a small comfort. No new lines or wrinkles marred the sculpted smoothness of her face. She didn't murmur a thanks to Sam, as she had been wont to do before finding the sign of aging. For over 30 years, following her revival from stasis, Erica Van Sloan had almost never looked at herself in the mirror. Confined to a wheelchair, she avoided her reflection with such a single-minded diligence, it was almost a superstitious obsession. As far as she was concerned, her identity had died during her century and a half in cryosuspension. Sloane had inherited her dark hair and eyes from her Brazilian mother, but she possessed her father's tall frame and long, solid legs. God only knew from which side of her family her 200-point IQ derived, but she knew she received her beautiful singing voice from her mother. At 18 years of age, the haughty, beautiful, and more than a little arrogant Erica earned her PhD in cybernetics and computer science. She wanted to pursue a singing career, but within days of her graduation from Caltech, she went to work for a major Silicon Valley hardware producer as a models and systems analyst. 8 months later, she left her six-figure-a-year salary to accept a position with a government-sponsored ultra-top-secret undertaking known as Overproject Whisper. Only much later did she realize Whisper was a major division of something called the Totality Concept, and she was assigned to one of its subdivisions, Operation Kronos. In the vast installation beneath a mesa in Dulce, New Mexico, she served as the subordinate, lover, and occasional victim of a man who made her own officious personality seem mousy and shy by comparison. Torrance Silas Burr was brilliant, stylish, waspish, and nasty. He excelled at using his enormous intellect and equally enormous ego to fuel his cruel sense of humor. The word love had never been part of Sloane's emotional vocabulary, so she substituted for it the word submission, and Burr took full advantage of her devotion. He delighted in belittling and degrading not just her, but other scientists assigned to Overproject Whisper. The one scientist he could not deride was Mohandas Lakesh Singh, the genius responsible for the final technological breakthrough of Project Cerberus, which permitted Operation Kronos to finally make some headway. When the world blew out on noon of January 20th, 2001, she ceased to think about Burr at all. Like everyone else in the anthill installation, she prayed the safety measures would kick in as they were designed to. But despite all of their precautions, radiation still trickled in. Bomb-triggered earthquakes caused extensive damage. Since the military and government personnel in charge had no choice but to remain in the facility, it took them a while to realize they were just as much victims of the nuke cost as those whom they referred to as the useless eaters of the world. Erica Van Sloane couldn't help but laugh to herself over the grim irony. Like their less educated counterparts, they had no real grasp of the scope of the global devastation. None of their painstaking calculations regarding acceptable losses, destruction ratios, and the length of the nuclear winter bore any resemblance to the terrifying reality. When this select few, this powerful elite, finally did come to terms with reality, it was too late to do much about it. They had assumed that after 5 years or less of waiting inside the anthill, a new world order would be in place. Now the schedule appeared to be closer to 20. Sloane didn't feel she was sacrificing much when she volunteered to enter a stasis canister for a period of time, to be resurrected at some future date when the sun shone again and the world was secure. When she awakened, more than a century had passed. During her long slumber, the anthill installation suffered near catastrophic damage. A number of stasis units had malfunctioned, hers among them. Due to that malfunction, she was resurrected as a cripple. Worse than finding out her long, shapely legs were little more than withered, atrophied sticks was learning the plans made for her while she slept. Sloane was briefed on the unification program and the baronial oligarchy. She was told that to be of optimal use to the Archon Directorate and their hybrid plenipotentiaries, she needed to be as fit as it was possible for a human in her physical condition and chronological age to be. Moreover, Sloane was informed she was only one of several pre-Holocaust humans, known as Freezies in current vernacular, resurrected to serve the baronies, and she should consider herself fortunate to be among their number. In other words, she was not to grieve, mourn, weep, or otherwise feel sorry for herself. She was to concentrate only on what her technological skills could contribute to the furtherance of the program of unification. Otherwise, she would be put out of her misery. She learned quickly not to question. Over the years of Sloane's long life, due to the creativity and skills of her intellect, she had undergone many organ transplants, so as to extend her value to the United Baronies. Despite the pain and suffering that had gone with each successive operation, Sloane never regained the use of her legs, and the neurological degeneration grew so acute she became a complete cripple. She hadn't realized how much she loved being young, beautiful, and vital until all of it was taken from her. Then Sam, her precious son, a mixture of her in vitro genetic material spliced with that of an Anunnaki, had given it back, or at least returned the promise of it. If she could enlist Lakesh to Sam's cause, Sam would restore her youth. Sloane ran her hands through her wet hair and tried to put the echo of Sam's words out of her mind. She was taking action, after all, putting into motion a plan that would eventually cause the Imperator's path to cross that of Lakesh again. Baron Beausoleil's soft voice startled her.
"Don't worry, we're still beautiful."
Sloane was unwilling to show surprise by turning.
"Where have you been?"
"Observing our guest."
Baron Beausoleil stepped closer, and her reflection slid across the mirrored squares. She was wearing the black Imperial uniform, the satin tunic stretched taut across her breasts and cinched tight at her narrow waist.
"How is she?"
Beausoleil ran her hands over Sloane's bare shoulders.
"Comfortable, but confused. Not a mental state she is accustomed to feeling."
Sloane repressed a smile. Confusion was not an emotion any of the hybrids, particularly the Barons, dealt with easily. She recalled their bewildered reactions when first they came to the realization the Archon Directorate did not exist, and then when they had first met Sam, who had been introduced to them by Balaam. At the time, Sloane could only imagine the thoughts careening and colliding within the oversized craniums of the Barons. For the entirety of their artificially prolonged lives, the Barons believed they served the will of the Archons. Or they convinced themselves they were the Directorate's servants, and therefore any action they undertook to safeguard their positions as the overlords of humankind was justified. But their probing intelligence needed proof, and without it, doubt inevitably ate away the belief structure. Although none of the Barons spoke of it, they had ceased to subscribe to the belief in the Archons. In which case, they were no longer content with their roles as the plenipotentiaries of a higher, grander authority. They had reached this conclusion tentatively, by degrees, over a period of time. When they finally did, they were as absolutely certain of it as they had been certain of the existence of the Archon Directorate. Now, dealing with the appearance of Balaam, their minds were in utter turmoil, fears, desires, and thoughts all crashing into each other. Baron Beausoleil had proved to be more resilient and adaptable than the others of the oligarchy, but Erica Van Sloane still wasn't sure how she felt about that. As the Baron continued to caress her, her arms and belly and breasts broke out in goose flesh, but it was not from arousal.
"Does Quavel know why she has been brought here?"
"She suspects. How could she not?"
"I want to speak with her."
Sloane stepped away from Baron Beausoleil's touch, reaching for her uniform hanging from a hook on the wall. The Baron's role as seducer hadn't fooled her, but the woman's willingness to please her was a surprise. She had not thought it possible for a new human, much less a Baron, to subsume her inborn arrogance and stratospheric sense of superiority to serve the needs of another, certainly not the needs of an old human. Sloane remembered her own submission to Burr and how she had done anything necessary to stay with him, at least for a while. She had been tremendously attracted to the sheer animal dynamism of the man, but now the memory of that devotion revolted her. Glancing into Baron Beausoleil's smiling face, she wondered how long it would take before the Baron assessed the depth of her submissiveness to the Imperial Mother and turned against her in order to add this far empire to her own holdings.